All we do as multifamily syndicators is we match up the money with the deal.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts passing on their experience and knowledge to our listeners. Thanks for joining us this week. My name is J. Darren Gross. We're so glad you're here. In just a minute, we're going to speak with multifamily investor Joe Fairless. He's an author, a podcast host, and a syndicator. We talked to him about multifamily syndication, how it works, and how he did it. But before we do, I want to invite you to subscribe to our podcast. If you like what we're doing, be sure to subscribe. You can do that on either iTunes or Stitcher, whichever you prefer. We are on both. It's super easy. Just go to iTunes or Stitcher and type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network in the search bar. And when you see our logo, that's the headphones with the CREPN between the ears, go ahead and click subscribe. And this will ensure that you receive all of our episodes and you can listen anytime you choose. In the car, at the gym, or even at your kid's soccer practice. When you do subscribe, be sure to leave a comment and let us know what you think. For those of you who don't know me, a little bit about me. I'm a real estate investor and a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for over 25 years. My primary clients are real estate professionals dealing in multifamily, retail, warehouse, office, and development. Also, I'm a real estate investor and have been for almost 20 years. And it's based on this that I'm always looking for more information about real estate so I can better support my clients and information I can use in my own investing. And that's how Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio came about. The easiest way to reach me is at jdarrengross.com, or you can also reach me at commercialrealestatepronetwork.com. Both of those buttons have the contact information, and go ahead and reach out to me there. Insurance is a part of any real estate transaction. And commercial real estate's a little different than your home and auto insurance. I encourage you to get your free copy of Real Estate Investor's Guide to Commercial Insurance. You can do that. It's on the jdarrengross.com site. It's a free gift to you, help you understand commercial real estate with respects to real estate investing. Or if you'd rather, you can give me a call, like I said, and I'll do everything I can to help you. That's what I do. If you're on LinkedIn, also want to encourage you to join our group. We've got a group, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. It's a great group of commercial real estate professionals. Good place to network and learn more. All right, let's get on with our show. All right, on the line today, I am fortunate to have my guest. His name is Joe Fairless. He's an investor. He's a syndicator. He's a disciple of Tony Robbins. He's also an author and a popular podcast host, the best ever real estate investing advice podcast. Joe, welcome to the program. Joe Fairless, that is.
Well,
program.
Yeah, thank you so much, Darren. Looking forward to our conversation.
Well, me too. And I appreciate you making some time for me. Before we jump into this, if you could do me a favor and the listeners a favor and just kind of fill in some of the background, how you got started in real estate and a little bit about you.
Sure. Let's see how I got started. I was working in advertising in New York City. I'm from Texas, but I moved straight to New York City after I graduated Texas Tech University, worked in advertising on Madison Avenue, which sounds good. And it was from a prestige standpoint, but also means I made less than minimum wage whenever I graduated college. And I didn't have any money. I was living in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, which at the time was the busiest police precinct in all the five boroughs of Brooklyn. Lots of shootings and stabbings around my neighborhood. And, it was quite eye-opening coming from Texas, and it was a good personal growth experience, that's for sure. I continued to be in advertising. And as I was in advertising, I'd climb the corporate ladder. I ended up becoming the youngest vice president of a New York City advertising agency. And along the way, I realized that I should keep my expenses low. So I stayed in, I moved once from East Flatbush to East Village, which they sound similar, but for anyone who's familiar with New York City, different neighborhoods. And I ended up staying in that East Village apartment for 9 years, living like a college student. My friends would make fun of me, but I kept my expenses fixed. As a result, as I kept climbing the corporate ladder in advertising, I would make more money. And as the youngest vice president, I was making $150,000, and not including a bonus. And so I was saving all the money, the majority of the money I was making. So I started investing in real estate. New York City was too expensive for me to buy in. So I looked back to Texas, where I was from, in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And in 2009, I ended up buying my first place. It was a four-bedroom house in Duncanville, Texas, which is about 15 minutes south of Dallas, for $76,000. Then I just started buying more. I ended up with buying four total single-family homes. And I was also teaching people in New York City about how to buy investment properties outside of New York, because a lot of people were in my situation where they're making some New York City money, so more than where you would in other markets, but they're not just rolling in the dough and they need to invest. So how do they do it? So I started teaching people how to do it. And simultaneously towards the end, I was, as you said, I'm a disciple of Tony Robbins, absolutely. Although his documentary I was a little disappointed in, that's another story. I was not fulfilled, and Tony Robbins talks about how we have six human needs, and the last two lead to fulfillment, which is growth and contribution. So if you're not growing, if you're not mentally stimulated by what you're doing, then you won't be fulfilled, and you also need to feel like you're contributing to something larger. I didn't feel that way about advertising anymore, so I remember sending an email out to my family telling them I came, I conquered, and I don't care about it, period, at all, period. I am leaving the advertising industry, and I'm going to go do my own thing. And at that time, I thought it would be career consulting, where I would be a consultant for college students and young professionals in marketing, advertising, and PR, and I'd help them climb the corporate ladder like I did. So while I was transitioning out of my job, I started in the background creating a website. And once I left, I launched the website and it was crickets. Nobody came. I didn't have any clients. Spent $3,000 on this website, and I needed to figure out what my approach was. Well, fortunately, I had been studying multifamily. And I realized that after I left my job, I couldn't get approved by any single family homes, but ironically, I could put together a deal and buy a multi-million-dollar apartment building. And what I did is I started talking to some people, and that class I was teaching on single family, I shared it with a couple of my friends, and they're like, "Well, I'm looking for do something larger. So if you do something larger, let me know." I heard that from two different people. I was like, "Wait a second, do I have customers before I have a product?" Because I just flopped miserably with something that I launched a product and I didn't have any customers. And lo and behold, I did. I had investors who wanted to invest with me, but I didn't have a product for them to invest in, the apartment building. Then I got serious about looking at apartment buildings and got underway.
So excuse me. So when you left New York, you said what, 2009, you bought your first place.
Mm-hmm.
What year did you end up leaving?
I left New York. I lived in New York from 2005 to about 2015.
Okay. And you've been investing in multifamily now since when?
For 3 years, since July of 2013.
Okay. All right. So you kind of set the stage here. You were teaching these classes and you were hearing the voices of like, if you're doing something bigger, I'd like to know. How did you jump or, I mean, that's kind of a mind shift from going from doing single family and teaching that, to going into multi-million dollar, you know, multifamily. How did you connect the dots? Was it basically you just kept hearing the whisper I mean, you'd been reading, it sounds like, or you'd been educating yourself on multifamily.
Yeah. I brought on consultants. I paid $250 a month to one consultant. I also read a bunch of books. I've read the majority of the multifamily books out there. And now I'm writing them. So it all comes full circle. But not only would I read the books, but I would reach out to the authors and I would attempt to give them something before asking them anything. And in one case, I ended up paying for their program and bought their program. That's one value exchange. So, you know, and now that I have the podcast, it gives me a license to reach out to anyone, really, and talk to them and get to know them and learn from them. So selfishly, I can learn a whole lot. And then I provide value because I give them the exposure to a large audience. But at the time, I didn't have the podcast. So it was attending conferences as well as those other things that I talked about.
All right. And the reason and one of the reasons, I mean, first of all, I'm a fan of yours, but one of the primary reasons I wanted to engage with you today was to talk about specifically that syndication. And in that, just for our listeners, because I think the word gets tossed around a lot, and like a lot of things, if you don't really understand it, you may assume that you do, or you haven't really dug into it to really understand what it is. Can you give us a little bit about, because that's what we're talking about here, is how you got into this multifamily, if I understand right. And maybe what we do is we start with, tell us about your first multifamily deal and how that came about, and maybe that would kind of lay some groundwork on how this came about.
Sure. My first deal, I was in New York City living there. I was looking in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because that's the market I had identified, but I wasn't getting any traction there. One thing I learned is that I went in thinking I was going to have a lot of credibility because I had, it's so funny to think of it now, but I had four single family homes. So I was like, hey, I'm a legit buyer. Yeah, because I was so proud of it. And I am. I'm still proud of the four single family homes that I bought. Because I bought it with my money and I bought it from money I earned climbing the corporate ladder in my profession. So I'm proud of that. But in the grand context of real estate investing, it's nothing. Right. And in commercial real estate brokers and property managers, I mean, now I look at it and it's like I was reaching out to them. I'd never purchased anything before. I lived in New York City. They're in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I mean, it's just, it's a recipe for disaster or inaction on their end. So I ended up actually going to Tulsa, didn't find anything, made offers, but everything was overpriced. And this was in 2013, everything was overpriced. So I kept my eyes open and came across another deal in Cincinnati. A broker that I know shared it with me. And I had never been to Cincinnati. I hadn't looked at the market, but I liked the parameters of the deal, so I had to then qualify the market. The more I looked at Cincinnati, the more I just loved it. From a job diversity standpoint, they have 9 Fortune 500 companies headquartered in Cincinnati, ranging from Kroger to Macy's to a steel company, Procter & Gamble. I mean, all sorts of different industries. Therefore, the market worked, the submarket worked. They just built the second largest Kroger in all of Ohio, a mile down the road from this property. And then the numbers worked. So what I did is I actually thought that I'd be able to raise about $400,000. And unfortunately, well, actually, initially, I was looking at Tulsa for 30 units, by the way. And I thought I could raise 200. So I was looking at 30 units. You know, $1 million properties, somewhere around there. I mean, I would have raised a little bit more. But then this deal came across as 168 units, And it was, you know, the purchase price was north of $6 million, $6.35 million. I was like, I don't know how to, I don't know how I'm going to raise down payment for this. I mean, 20% is like $1.3 million.
Right.
So I talked to the brokers, and they're like, well, here's the deal on this property. There's a large prepayment penalty. So you don't need to bring all the money, because what we're going to do is we're going to do something called a master lease with option to purchase. Other places called a land contract, and there's installment sales. It could be classified as, depending on how you approach it. And I was like, okay, well, let me study up on that first off. So the learning curve was really big on my first deal, because it's not just a straightforward deal. It's something creative. But turns out it was actually a lot easier than doing a straightforward deal, because there wasn't a lender involved in the capacity they're typically involved in, because the current owner stayed on the mortgage as a personal guarantor, and we just got the lender's approval that this transaction, what we were doing, was okay by them. And that's key. One thing when people talk about master lease with option to purchase and installment sales and land contracts, they typically, 99 out of 100 times, don't mention that you need to get the lender's approval to do it. Otherwise, the due on sale clause could be triggered. And right. If it is, then all your money goes poof, goodbye. Right. So that's really key. And that's something that needs to be stated. I actually delayed the closing 1 month, which was one long, long, painful month, because I saw in the contract, and all everyone else in the transaction was like, okay, ready to close. I remember going to the closing table. It was incredibly awkward. I'd never actually gone to a closing table before, because I'd never seen my homes, those four homes, in person before I bought them. So I would always close remotely. So this is like a big old learning curve. I remember going to the closing table like, we're not closing today. And it was a room full of attorneys and title people and the seller, and it was just tough. It was really tough.
Yeah, that's not usually the. I mean, usually the buyer's not the guy that.
That's
saying that. It's usually a lender or somebody else that's pulling the strings.
Yeah, but I needed to make sure that we had in writing that the lender was okay with the transaction. We got it in writing, and a month later. And the reason why we did the master lease is the prepayment penalty was $1 million. So if we put a new loan on it, then someone would have had to pay $1 million. If we assumed it, then the loan was just bad and it didn't make sense to pay the fee for the assumption. So the best path of least resistance was the prepayment penalty, or was the master lease. And we got the principal pay down every month. So every month we pay the mortgage, the principal pay down, the principal on the loan decreases $15,000, so we get $15,000 in equity every month. We've had it for 3 years now, almost exactly 3 years, and in the process of selling and moving on to something else.
I love the creative financing there, because I mean, that's one thing that's kind of drawn me to real estate. Even in just my first deal, it was just literally that. It was somebody asking for something and then trying to figure out a different way to get there and being open to all options. And that's something I hadn't heard the master lease or how that works. That's thank you for sharing that.
Yep.
So let's back up here a little bit. So you said you were looking in Oklahoma. You were looking for deals around $1 million. You figured you could raise about $200,000.
Right.
And now you're jumping into something that's was it $6 million? Did you say on the or north of $6 million?
On my first deal,
right?
Yeah, right. $6.35 million.
So raising that down payment, that's kind of there's a gap between your initial thoughts of $200,000 to. I'm assuming that you said 20%, what 1.2 million?
Yeah, there's a huge gap.
Yeah. So how, tell us, and there's kind of two things I want to understand here and hope we can lay out for listeners. So one is the raising of the capital, but then there's all the I guess the setup and how an actual syndication works. Because what you said was that a broker that you'd known had shown you the deal. And so at that point, are you putting an offer out, or now are you going out to your potential investors and soliciting their interest to raise the down payment, or how? Kind of give us the mechanics or kind of the timeline of that, if you would.
Well, do you want to talk about how I did it on my first deal, or how you're supposed to do it and how I've done it on deals there, the other deals that I've done it correctly?
Well, I'd be interested in, because I think this is the whether you call it the school of hard knocks or just the, you know, real live bullets or whatever you want to call it. I think there is always the theory, but then there's also, you know, what really happens and how creative you have to be. So maybe with a way to do this is how you're supposed to do it. And then maybe we can back into it if we have time on how you did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And how you're supposed to do it is how I do it now. So it's not, fortunately, it's not just theory. It's how I approach things now. And then I'll mention, perhaps I'll mention along the way how I did it on the first deal and kind of juxtapose it. So how you do it now is, and how I do it now is, you build anticipation with investors prior to having a deal. A lot of people ask, should I get the deal first? Should I get the investors first? You always get the investors first. You don't have them wire money. You don't do anything formal other than you talk to them about your business plan. You learn about their goals. You learn about what success looks like for them on investing. You learn that if they want to be passive or active, by the way, we only work with passive investors. I actually told an investor last week when we met that this type of investment structure is not for him. Because he wanted to be at the property at 8 a.m. and, you know, get hands-on. Absolutely not. That would be more of a headache and, in fact, be a nightmare for me. And a liability, a literal liability. And I told him, you're not the right investor for what I do. And it was refreshing for me to say it, and it was, I'm sure, refreshing for him to hear someone tell him that. So you ask them questions about how they want to approach things. And then you talk to them about your business model. And then at the end, you ask them, if I find something that meets your financial goals of XYZ, would you like me to share it with you? Everyone says, yes, yes, sure. I'd love for you to share it with me if you find something that meets the financial goals of what we just discussed. You put them on your list. I have a spreadsheet that I keep as well as a MailChimp email database. But for my accredited investors, and this is people who have 250,000 or $1 million net worth, not including their primary residence, 250,000 earned income and reasonable expectation to earn it next year too, or this year. So I have a special list of those individuals who I know, and they receive my deals. They also receive, you know, special things that I give them. Like when I published my book, I mailed them autographed copies of my book and I gave them an extra copy so they could share it with a friend. That type of stuff. I keep track of them much more closely than I do my people who subscribe to my newsletter, where I don't have as much information and is not as high level of touch with them. So the way to do it is to build anticipation with investors. Then you go, once you have 30% more than what you think you need, verbally committed or verbal interest, then you can go look at deals. Because you're going to have people that back out for whatever reason, because they had a death in the family, because their finances have changed, because they just don't like your stuff anymore. I mean, all sorts of reasons.
Right.
So once you have the anticipation built more than 30% of what you think you need on the deal, and that includes down payment, closing costs, your fees, operating budget, everything that you will need, then you go to brokers and you say, hey, this is what I got going on. This is the type of deal I'm looking for. And then then start looking at deals while simultaneously working the off-market angle of attempting to get deals directly from the owner, because you can usually get better deals that way. And that's assuming, of course, you've already selected your market and identified exactly what you want to purchase. But assuming you got those things done, then you you get rocking on finding a deal.
Couple of questions on what you were saying. you mentioned you know, the investors that express interest, and I appreciate you putting a number there that 30% more than what you're going to need. I was kind of curious as to what the fallout was. But then the market area, when you explain to them, here's what I'm looking at, do you have it narrowed down to, we're looking to go get a property in this market at this cap rate? Or what is it when you're talking with your potential investors that you're presenting? Is it, I mean, how finite or mm-hmm. how detailed is that?
Well,
that message that you're providing.
Well, on my first deal, when I was talking to people, I made the mistake of saying, I'm looking at Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're going to buy something in Tulsa. And then I had to do a 180 and go talk to them about Cincinnati. Don't make that same mistake. Talk to them about the market characteristics that you're looking at, how you identify the market. And what are the indicators you look for? So specifically, what I look for now would be a market that, I mentioned this about Cincinnati, that has a diverse employment. You don't want it to depend on just one industry. Look at Detroit. I was born in Flint, Michigan, so I know Michigan decently well, even though I grew up in Texas for the most part. So job diversity with lots of different employers and industries, job growth, and then supply and demand. So what is the occupancy? What are the vacancy trends? What submarkets are, what are they trending towards? Where is the path of progress? And there are other less important, but still factors I look at, like landlord friendly states, like different natural resources that will always be there regardless of what the economy does. But jobs and supply and demand are the two most important factors that I look at. And then, you know, obviously with, or perhaps not obvious, but because it wasn't initially to me, but now it's something that I disqualify markets on, and if the cap rate is so low and it's about, I say a five cap, if it's lower than a five cap, it's going to be tough to buy for cash flow and not buy to speculate. So like New York City, I mean, it's very tough to buy a cash flowing property and then turning it around and adding value and doing the business model that we do. So, you know, we look in the South, the Midwest. You know, I have a 250 unit in Houston, 155 unit in Houston, a 320 unit in Dallas, 168 unit in Cincinnati, where we, as we speak now, I have a 298 unit under contract in Dallas. So, you know, you get a sense of the markets that we're looking at, but we're not exclusively looking in those markets. We just happen to find the good opportunities right now.
Right. So I'm kind of similar. So the parameters of the marketplace are kind of more of what you're presenting to your potential investors. And that you talked about the cap rate. Are most of your investors, are they looking for a regular rate of return, or is that something that you kind of qualify up front that there will be, you know, a regular cash flow? Or how does that work on the operating of the property? Or is it just We're going to work this. We're going to get the rents up. We're going to turn this property, and in X number of years, we expect a sale, and we expect possibility of this rate of return. How do you? Am I making sense on what I'm asking?
Yeah, yeah. I structure it where we have an 8% preferred return to investors, so they get the first 8% of the profits. After all the, the expenses are paid for and reserves and all that good stuff. Then we split the profits either 70-30 or 50-50 after that. And then there may or may not be a performance hurdle, and that depends on the deal. So for example, they'll get maybe 70% and we get 30, we meaning the general partnership, then investors meaning limited partnership, they get 70%, we get 30%. But then once they reach a 20% internal rate of return, then we split it 50-50.
Gotcha. And one of my curiosities too is on these, when you go out and you raise capital and you get your investors, do you hold an equity position in those, or is that part of the formula, or is it more of your managing as a general partner? How is that?
Yeah, we it's 70-30 with the equity ownership. So 70% limited partners, 30% general partners. And we invest of the 100% that's required to close. We'll usually and the percentage varies, but we'll usually bring $200,000 of our own money. So whatever percent that ends up being is dependent on the deal, but we'll invest 1 to 200 depending on the different partners that we have in place. But we'll always do it a 70-30 split.
Gotcha. And do the investments, or actually the syndication of the deal, is it always specific to a property itself?
Yes.
Or okay.
Yep. Yeah. The evolution will be to do a fund, which would be the other option, where we raise money for a fund, not a particular property, and then we have $100 million in the fund. We use that to go invest in properties, and there's not a deal by deal approval process. But right now we're doing it deal by deal.
Got it. And when you make these investments, you mentioned you're already set to roll out of the Cincinnati property. What kind of a sunset do you set when you're talking with your investors? Is there a kind of a calendar of an expectation of a liquidation?
Or 5 years.
5 years?
Yep. Every one of our deals we project that will hold for 5 years, and then we'll sell at the end of 5 years.
Gotcha. And as far as the setup goes, I understand the accredited investor. I mean, there's a process to determining who's accredited. Is it essentially an SEC regulated thing when you go syndicate, or how deep does that go? I mean, I'm assuming there's a legal document where everybody becomes a quote partner at a percentage level, or a stockholder, in the entity that's going to make the purchase. Is that all pretty much boilerplate documentation, or does that vary quite a bit from property to property, or is that
if you have the same general partnership structure and you use the same overall structure with investors, then it's pretty similar. The specific documents, and obviously disclaimer, I'm not an attorney, but you'll want to talk to a securities attorney. But the documents that we use are, one, the private placement memorandum, and that's a 150-page document that says you'll lose every penny. Right. The world's going to end. Two is a operating agreement for the investors to review and sign, and that's the operating agreement you have with them within the entity that you've created, and how it's structured, and who gets paid what, and what's the pecking order, and
how you vote and all that good stuff. So it's just similar to an operating agreement you would do in any other venture. And then three is an investor qualifier, where they fill out how they're qualified to ensure that they are accredited investors.
Got it. So you have the funds put together with your I guess, do you call it, is it a syndicate, or what sure. do you call it once you have that group together? Is that what we
yeah.
call it?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Okay. So you have your syndicate together, you approach the broker, you say, hey, this is what we're looking for. Show me what you got. Do you find, and you mentioned the off-market deals, do you employ the broker to do that for you, go out and find those opportunities, or do you have other means to do that as well?
Yeah, there's all sorts of ways that we do it. The traditional way, which is you talk to brokers and then they send you the deals that they have. Then you've got the pocket listings that they'll send you before they send to anyone else, before they actually send out the email. And then you've got the off-market deals, which they might go call on owners on your behalf, depending on how strong of a buyer you are. Then you've got the off-market deals where you don't work with a broker and you do different ways to get those deals. And I have a guide on my website, just my homepage, joefairless.com, and it's 24 ways to get off-market deals. So you can opt in there and get that guide, and it lists 24 different ways. Ultimately, we need to have a funnel with multiple methods of getting deals, just like we need to have a funnel with multiple methods of getting investors, because all we do as multifamily syndicators is we match up the money with the deal. From right. a very high level, we got to have money and we got to have a deal. So therefore, we got to make sure that we have multiple ways to get the money and multiple ways to get the deal.
Right. Do you ever engage in any of these, I forget what they call them, the call to bid or
auction, like auction.com?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Okay. Okay. And what kind of time frame do you, or have you experienced from once you have the syndication put together, you go to market? What have you experienced as far as how long has it taken you to find a place to deploy the capital?
I'd say, it's an ongoing process. But for my first deal, and because I wanted to mention what I did on the first deal versus
I want to circle
this.
Back there.
Yeah, the first deal, I didn't get the money raised. I found the deal, and then I was scrambling, and it was a character building experience I never want to do again. It's terrible. I had an investor back out, actually two of them back out a couple weeks before we were supposed to close for a total of $250,000.
Was that the first close or the second close?
The first one. The first one, yeah. So I had to scramble big time, and one of my current investors ended up just covering it, which was amazing. And I would have found a way to make it happen, but and I did because he covered it. So that's not a situation where you want to put yourself in. As far as the timeline goes, now that I do it the proper way, where you continually have are a marketing machine and you have investor conversations and you put yourself in the right situations. It's in Dallas right now. We're doing 60-day closes. Once we have it under contract, we have 60 days, calendar days, to close. Therefore, we are up and running with the investment package the day that we close. That way we can start sharing it with investors and having a conference call with them and starting to get commitments quickly.
Do you find is there any momentum that you're finding now that you've got several deals under your belt and also you know, in these two markets, specifically Houston and Dallas, do you find that brokers are calling you and saying, hey, Joe, let me know when you're ready to do another one. We've got something I think you might be interested in, or is there anything like that?
Yeah, tons of momentum. I haven't reached a tipping point yet where when I have a deal and I send it out to my group of accredited investors, it funds in 24 hours. Not there yet, but I'm getting there quickly. And I'll give you a specific example. Last Wednesday morning, I had an email go out about this deal I'm doing right now, this 298 unit in Dallas. Went out at 5 a.m. I then was flying from Cincinnati to Dallas, so I didn't have internet access. When I get it to Dallas and I check my email, and this is probably like 9 a.m. or something, I have a bunch of responses from current investors, and one of them is from an investor, and in the email had like 4 or 5 bullet points on the deal. Didn't have the investment package. The investment package about 28, 29 PowerPoint slides. Didn't have that. Just had the deal, and we do a video on the deal that's only seen by my accredited investors I know. He replied and he said, I'm in for 500,000 because I made the maximum 500K. He just did the maximum. He hadn't even seen the deal. He's invested with me before, so it's not like this is just some guy who I don't know and has never invested with me. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll do this. No, this is a guy who I know very well. And he was in for 500 without even looking at the investment package, just off an email. That's a snippet of where I want to get to and where I'm getting to, but I'm not completely there yet. Another example, when I was actually going to Dallas because I was looking at the deal we have under contract, the 298 units, and I was also looking at a deal that we are bidding on, so I'm going to be a little bit cryptic about this one, but it's about the same size, and that deal is with one investor, just one. He's bringing $3.5 million, and I met him. Guess how I met him?
I give up.
I met him through the Contact Us page on my website. He emailed me because he heard me on a podcast being interviewed. He heard me on a podcast being interviewed. He then emailed me. He was listening to my podcast after that, and he's invested in two of my other deals, a significant amount. I had no idea he had the capability to bring $3.5 million, and he is. He's bringing $3.5 million. He's going to be the only investor. So the more we put ourselves out there, the more we have a consistent, again, it's a marketing machine to get deals and to get the investor relationships and the friendships, the more successful that we're going to be. And eventually there will be a tipping point for me where I send out the email and I've got it filled up within 24 hours.
Yeah, no, that's impressive, especially, you know, if you just rewind the clock here, just 3 years ago when you were starting with your first deal?
Yeah.
And if I remember right, you said you did not at that point have the podcast?
No, I did not.
I'm impressed. The investing from the few units you did to raising the capital, working through that first deal, and now literally sending out emails and getting commitments in hours. That's impressive, Joe.
Well, thanks. And I think it ties back to a couple qualities. One is I'm incredibly resourceful. I pride myself on being the most resourceful person anyone I come across meets in their life. I will find a way to make it happen. As long as it makes sense to make it happen, I will find a way to make it happen. I'm very resourceful. The second thing is I'm a dog with the bone when I'm into something. I just won't let up. I'll just continue to go, go, go. And the podcast is an example of that. It's the world's longest running daily real estate podcast. Nobody on the face of the earth has done a daily real estate podcast as long as I have. And there's a ton of benefit in that. Google searches, you know, my name is friendly with Google. But more important, it builds relationships with people all across the nation who are doing real estate deals. It expands my network, and I learn a whole lot from it. And I suspect that you and I wouldn't even be talking if I didn't have this podcast, because I would be doing something else. So, you know, it builds relationships. It's building relationships right now between you and I and your listeners. So those are the types of – those two things in particular stand out to me when I look back on it. And, you know, granted, I got a long way to go. My goal is to control $1 billion before my 40th birthday. I'm 34 years old, and I'm at $54 million, not including the couple transactions that are under contract and or about to be under contract. So, you know, I'll keep plugging away. And the reason why that's my goal is because I believe that when I get to $1 billion, then I will have such massive influence that I will be able to contribute in a much greater way than I currently do. Even though my structure is to contribute while I grow, I know that when I get to that billion mark, that my contribution level will be exponential for what it is right now. That and it'll be cool to say.
No, I'm impressed, and you know, just you're clearly you're making it happen, and clearly people are taking note, and I think that's probably the consistency that investors are looking for, and the fact that you're not just talking, but you're actually doing. I think that speaks volumes for anybody that's considering investing. And I wanted to ask you. You mentioned the give back, and I'm familiar with Tony Robbins from the standpoint of, I know he's a motivational speaker, and I know that he's got an incredible following. And there's several people that I enjoy following that talk about it. But I'm curious, what are you doing right now as far as your giving back? What are you doing?
Every year for the last 4 or 5 years, I think five. I've sent a Texas Tech student to New York City to intern, or not to intern, to job shadow for 3 days. So I've paid for the flight, paid for the hotel. I've set up the schedule so that they can learn in New York City about what it's like to compete in advertising, because that's what I did. I went from Lubbock, Texas to New York City, and it was a game changer for me, because in my opinion, the best of the best compete in New York City in advertising. And I wanted to compete with the best of the best in advertising. So I went to New York City, and it opened up my mind, and also it opened up career potentials and opportunities. So I've done that. I've sponsored that for the last 5 years. I also am a volunteer for Junior Achievement. I'm on the board for Junior Achievement, helping underserved kids and communities. I am and have donated every single penny of profit from the sales of my book, Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever, Volume 1, to Junior Achievement. So I'm not making a penny on the sales of my book because I'm donating it all to Junior Achievement. So that's another thing. I'm also have been on the board of directors for the College of Media and Communication at Texas Tech for the last 8-9 years, and I help college kids in that way, you know. And there's a couple other things too, but those are the ways that I do it formally, and then informally, I think it's, you know, just through the podcast and other methods that give back on a more business basis.
Well, I love the working with college age students and just youth. I the college experience, and especially you know, the opportunity to go to New York or just anywhere. I'm from the Midwest, grew up in Kansas, and had my mind blown when I went to France on an exchange. And it was just to see the world at that age and to be exposed to it, like how much bigger the world is than your little world that you grew up in, can only help, you know, expand people's vision and just what the opportunities really are and how to go there, how to achieve and how to get in the game there. So that's, mm-hmm. that's awesome. Joe, I'm kind of running through it. I'm looking at the time here. I don't want to, take your whole day here. I really appreciate you taking a minute to do this. Before we go, I want to kind of ask you, and this is kind of almost a steal from your show, but what would you, as far as the best advice for somebody who's looking to get into syndication, what would you lay out there as far as somebody, what they should consider? What should they do?
Well, you got to establish the knowledge, your foundation knowledge. And that is, you got to know the basics first before you start trying to do it. You can email me, info@joefairless.com, and I've got a free apartment resources guide. So just ask for that, info@joefairless.com, and someone on my team will send that to you. Once you establish that, and that guide has books, it has podcasts, that has websites that I go to look at research trends. Most of them are free, I think. LoopNet might be in there. That's paid. So surround yourself with the resources and immerse yourself with the content. Once you've mastered that or have at least a working knowledge, then you bring on someone who will help you get there, because that working knowledge of those documents and podcasts and websites, it's stale, it's not dynamic, and our deals are completely dynamic. Things happen that aren't on the podcasts, that aren't in the books, that aren't on these websites, aren't in the forums. So you've got to have someone or some ones helping you along the way. So you've got to align yourself with the right people, because this is I might have simplified it. And the reason I did is because it's important to simplify things so that people take action. But let's be frank here. I mean, this is a shark tank. Like you are competing at the highest level. When you do multifamily syndication and you're bringing in investor money, this is serious stuff. And if you mess up, you could be screwed for the foreseeable future. So you've got to surround yourself with people who know how to do it and are currently doing it, because it's not the single family home game. This is major league stuff. So that's the second thing you want to do. And then the third is you just follow the blueprint that others have done before, and you should have similar results and even better results, because now you have the benefit of seeing what they did and didn't do and what they should have done.
I like it. It's the ability to have that working knowledge and just the differentiation between, you know, reading it and actually living it. That's important. And then just kind of that awareness, like you said, it's real. And it's serious too. You know, you can't screw it up at that level. Otherwise, like you said, you will be screwed. Mm-hmm. So, but I appreciate that. Joe, best way for somebody to get in touch with you?
Well, you can email me info@joefairless.com, and you can get that free resources guide. And then you can, you know, go check out my website too, which is joefairless.com, which has the podcast episodes and that 24 ways to get off market deals document on the homepage.
Got it. And I want to encourage anybody that hasn't listened to your show. I mean, I'm so impressed. The daily thing just kills me how you knock out a daily show, because it's a lot of work and very impressive. Joe, I want to say thanks again for taking some time, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again soon.
Awesome. Sounds good. Great talking to you.
Multifamily syndication. It's like Joe said, it's a shark tank. You need knowledge And you also need some help. You need to find somebody who's done it and see if you can work with them. I want to encourage you to check out Joe's podcast and his website. That's at joefairless.com. You can check the link in the show notes and reach him that way. He's an impressive guy. He's got an impressive show. He does a daily show, which just always amazes me, and I'm sure you'll like it. Before we close up here, I want to encourage you also to be sure to subscribe to our show. Again, that way you'll know exactly when a new episode is posted. We know you're busy. We thank you for making time for us today. We appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.